The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Points of View.
Good afternoon. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here on News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. You can tune in. You can listen to the podcast afterwards. It's available on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website and on NewsDissector.com, the web blog that I write every day. The telephone number here to call in, 888-874-4888, a toll-free number, 888-874-4888. We're going to be talking about Occupy Wall Street. We're going to be talking about the economic crisis. We're going to be talking about China with Loretta Napoleone, who's a fantastic author and writer, author of Rogue Economics. She appears in my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. I ran into her at Occupy Wall Street. She agreed to come on the program. She's on the West Coast. We'll be getting to her in a few minutes. And then in the second half, we'll be talking to Todd Gitlin, who wrote a big essay in the New York Times about Occupy Wall Street. Todd, among other things, is a Columbia professor, a former president of the Students for a Democratic Society. So SDS in the day, back in the day. So we'll be hearing about that. But first, here in New York this morning, 6 a.m., the crowds engulfed the park, Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan today because of rumors and a threat of a police-supported, quote, cleanup of the site, which would have resulted in the clearing out of the people who've been there. This followed a visit to Zuccotti Park by Mayor Michael Bloomberg. I was there when the mayor arrived. He was on a sort of stealth mission. He walked through the park, you know, in about 2 minutes. He didn't talk to anybody. Probably couldn't have seen very much because it was dark at the time. But nevertheless, after this inspection, not even a white glove inspection, he concluded that the park was filthy. It needed to be cleaned up. The people had to be pushed out of the park so that a proper cleanup could be done by the realty company, Brookfield Properties, that owns Zuccotti Park but operates it supposedly in the public interest. So a confrontation seemed to be looming, seemed to be inevitable. Mayor wouldn't back down. Activists said, no way, we're not leaving this site. And they basically summoned support from their supporters. Labor unions were there, activists from community groups. The place was surrounded, and the police, of course, were there. And also Kat, the member of the News Dissector radio team, was there this morning. Kat, what was it like when you first arrived at 6:15? This morning?
When I got there, people were cleaning up, the protesters, the people that sleep there. They have been cleaning up all night long. And so, I mean, if Bloomberg wants them to clean up, they do it. But, you know, the question is Bloomberg going to clean up?
Right. One of the signs down at Zuccotti Park was, we will clean our community today and we'll clean up Wall Street tomorrow.
Exactly.
And so what happened next?
Bloomberg backed down. What happened last night, I was there last night, and there was a press conference on the southeast side of the street, and there were council members on the side.
City Council of New York, yeah.
Right. And on the mainstream media, actually, on the side of the protesters, you know, telling Bloomberg directly, I mean, how can you stop democracy? This is ridiculous. These protesters are doing what you should be doing. They're doing a better cleanup job than he is.
Yeah, but obviously it wasn't just about a cleanup.
Right.
The cleanup idea was a pretext for a clear out.
Right.
It was a kind of cleansing, a political cleansing of the park. That's what was expected. The police were expected to go in there and back up the so-called real estate company that had written them a letter expressing concern that people can't walk through the park at 3 in the morning, some other preposterous claim. And as a result, it looked like a confrontation was about to happen. But at the last minute, the Bloomberg administration and the real estate company sort of backed down. They agreed to have discussions with the people of Occupy Wall Street. So Occupy Wall Street has lived to fight another day. And now afterwards, people felt buoyant. There were victory marches. There was a sense of the people united will never be defeated. And a group broke away to march on Wall Street. What happened there?
Well, a bunch of marchers went north on Broadway up towards City Hall. And I was part of the group that went down Broadway, past the Bull, and then we came up Beaver, and it started out with the protesters staying on the sidewalk. You know, the cops keep everybody on the sidewalk. And then once we passed the bull, people just started kind of breaking out into the street and saying, you know, we don't want to be herded. It defeats the whole purpose. And so people were busting out into the street, and motorcycle cops started to come. I mean, I didn't see any real violence happening. I think a few people got arrested.
What was reported was that one of the motorcycles actually struck someone in the street. Somebody reacted. There was a tussle with a police commander. I don't know if it was a white shirt. Mm. The police then went, you know, back into form and started, you know, battling with people and arresting. Four people, I'm told, maybe more, were arrested. But you see, they've created a no-go zone, like they used to in Northern Ireland, where you can't actually demonstrate on Wall Street. They basically suspended the First Amendment on Wall Street just unilaterally by police power. There's no real estate company there. They did it themselves, and this is what people are objecting to. In any event, you know, there was a sense, in a way, that this is like a totalitarianism in New York, you know, that behind the facade of democracy and freedom, you have this authoritarian presence in the form of Mayor Bloomberg and the New York Police Department, which are maintaining surveillance on everybody. There are special trucks there just monitoring everybody that moves. It's almost like China, which is what we're going to be talking about now. Next, when Loretta Napoleone joins us. But first, a song by David Rovix, Occupy Wall Street.
Because this is where they buy the politicians. Because this is where the power has its seat. Because 99% of us are suffering at the mercy of the madmen on this street. Because all of us are victims of class warfare being waged on us by the 1%. Because these greedy banksters robbed the country, leaving us without the means to pay the rent. Because the last time that we had a decent government was about 1932. Because we the people are supposed to run this country, but instead it's all run by and for the few. Because now we know the rich do not pay taxes, but when they need a hand, it's us who bail them out. Because we suspected we lived in a plutocracy, but suddenly of late there is no doubt, and so we're gonna stay.
We're going to stay right here. David Rovix, Occupy Wall Street. We're going to hear more of it at the end of the program today. But joining me from out west somewhere, I don't know exactly where, Loretta Napoleone. She's Italian. She's a brilliant economist. She's a brilliant writer. And her new book is called Malnomics, Why Chinese Communists Make Better Capitalists Than We Do. And, of course, you know, as the American economy is going down or has been going down, the Chinese economy appears to be going up. What's the secret? How have they pulled this off? Have they lost their revolutionary elan completely? Is the China of Mao just a memory to be worshipped, you know, like a cult status of the leader, or is there more to it? Mao Zedong once said, you know, no investigation, no right to speak. Great quote. Now, Loretta has done an investigation. Tell us about it.
Hi, Danny. I'm in Seattle, actually.
Okay.
In West. Well, I think what we can say in relation also to what is happening today in the West is that in China, in the last 20 years, the social contract between the government, which is, of course, you know, the Communist Party, and the people, has been renegotiated. And this renegotiation has produced an agreement whereby the government guarantees economic freedom. So in other words, you know, the communist system, the communist economic system has been adapted to the needs of globalization in order to allow people to reap the benefits of this process in exchange for this economic freedom. So that brought, of course, you know, welfare and economic development. the population lets the party run the political show, and so the party decides foreign policy, the party decides which policy to pursue, including the decision not to open up Chinese finance to deregulation, although the U.S. and the European were putting tremendous pressure around the Chinese to do that.
This is the sound of the United States vis-a-vis China. please. It seems as if, you know, they've been begging the Chinese to deregulate. And the Chinese are saying, you know, if we do it, we're going to have 10 million people out of work, among other things. I mean, it seems as if, you know, there's a conflict here, but they now have the economic clout to resist, you know, this type of pressure where many other countries have buckled to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chinese have been very clever. The Chinese have done what was important for China, and this is why we don't have the kind of demonstration that we have here in the West. For sure, we don't have a inequality progressing through the economy as we've seen in the last 20 years in the West. And the economic situation of China in relation to the rest of the world is actually, you know, very, very good. The Chinese have been growing between 8 and 9% since 2008, while, you know, of course, you know, we went to zero growth. The problem now will be this new contraction of the economy. Will the Chinese be successful, as they've been in 2009, in compensating the fall in export through an increase in domestic demand? I think, you know, they probably will, because they have enough money to pump into the real economy, which means they're not pumping money into the banks. They're not saving finance, because finance is not in trouble, because finance is still, you know, very much controlled by the state. Well, but they're pumping money through the banks into the economy.
What I find fascinating about your writing, first of all, is it's very clear, very non, you know, economistic and obscurantistic, if that's a word. You know, I find myself learning a lot from reading this book. It's published, by the way, by Seven Stories Press, Maonomics. And one of the things that you talk about here is almost as if China has introduced a New Deal type policy, similar to the New Deal we had in our country, that is government-driven economic change and growth, while we in our country are moving away from it and stagnating and going down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see, China is very much a country that has modernized and is still modernizing, of course, because it's still a developing country, using the classical model of development. They reproduced the Industrial Revolution in modern times, and, you know, against the backdrop of globalization. At the same time, you know, their policy, it is very much a sort of Keynesian policy. So
Keynesian, by Keynes, you mean?
Yeah.
So what
they did after 2008 was actually to expand the economy through government intervention, which is exactly the same thing that, you know, Keynes suggested the U.S. should do after, you know, the crisis of 1929. While we, on the other end, in the West, we have abandoned that kind of policy. So the response, for example, of the European to the euro crisis is actually reduction in government spending, so austerity programs, which of course, you know, now are backfiring. So we are in a situation like in Greece, for example, where the GDP, the growth, is contracting by 7.3%. So in China...
About Greece, I mean, did anybody... Supposedly that's a democracy, a Western democracy. In fact, it's the home of democracy in many ways, historically. And yet, yes, I don't think the people of Greece were consulted about these austerity programs. I mean, it seems like they've been imposed, not even by, you know, through the Greek government, not even by the Greek government, with pressure on them by, you know, bondholders, Western financial institutions, other European financial institutions, who are forcing this so-called austerity, which is leading to mass unemployment in Greece.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I noticed in this last 10 days I've spent in the U.S. is that there is very little news and information about what is happening in Greece. I mean, in Greece there are riots on a daily basis. I mean, the population is dead against this austerity program, which has been introduced several times, meaning the austerity doesn't work, and therefore, you know, they go back and vote more austerity. We have a situation in Greece where there are no medicine in hospitals because the big multinational companies are not selling any more medicine to Greece because they're afraid that they won't be able to pay. So, I mean, this is how bad is the situation in Greece, and clearly the government has taken a decision against the will of the people and without asking the people. The majority of the Greece, and majority of the indignados in Greece, which is basically the origin of this Occupy Wall Street movement, which started in Europe the 15th of May of this year, do not want to defend the euro. They actually want the country to get out of the euro and pursue a more expansionary policy in order to restart the economy.
Well, you know, to me, what's quite fascinating about this, I went to the Plaza del Sol in Madrid this summer in June and visited with the people there. It's very much the flavor of Occupy Wall Street. I mean, it's democratic with a small d. It's people voting consensus about what to do, opposing the main political parties, the same kind of rebellious and yet practical approach. It's very impressive in that respect. Yet we have so much concentration of power at the highest levels of the society, including in China. I mean, in China, China is probably the number one country in terms of protests and demonstrations against corruption and land theft, you know, at the local level, more than at the national level.
Yeah, I mean, China is a country where people protest all the time. And the idea that we have of China, of course, is very, very different. We think, you know, the Chinese are repressed. And we think of China as we thought of the Soviet Union. I think that's the mistake. In reality, in China, there are constant protests. I mean, workers, for example, citizens, people that protest against environmental degradation of the country. So there is this kind of relationship, which is a very alive relationship between the street and the government. And of course,
Let me just jump in here. This is an important point for Americans to recognize. We see China, or we're basically taught to see China, you know, as a country in which, you know, the party, the people at the top impose everything on the people. But there's a tremendous amount of pushback from the people, and there's a lot of, you know, lack of applying. You know, they try to regulate the internet. Chinese, you know, internet kids, you know, kind of work around it, you know, and manage to have an internet despite the restrictions and what have you. And also, you know, in China, you know, you have, you know, it seems to me a right to petition the government in the Constitution. It might not be carefully observed, but it's there. And so you have a sort of democratic spirit there, even if you don't have a so-called democracy.
Yeah, it's a different way of democracy. You know, the word democracy in China is used to describe the fact that is the People's Republic of China, meaning, you know, who owns the country is the people. Mao used these words very, very often. In the constitution of China, the word democracy is very recurrent. But it's not the democracy we know. I mean, it's not the democracy that you go and vote every 4 years. It's actually more a democracy as a sort of interaction built in the system that starts from the bottom and goes all the way up. The Communist Party is very democratic. People are elected within the party in order to become, you know, the rulers.
When I was in China, in Beijing, you know, I went to a television conference with TV producers there, and there was a film done about, you know, a local election in which the person chosen by the Communist Party was rejected by the people. And it's this kind of documented, you know, actually how this whole thing happened. I don't want to idealize it. Clearly, there are restraints and restrictions, and people are suffering in prison in China as they are in our own country and other countries. But you know, it was something I didn't know before. And I think our view of China is a narrow one. You know, yeah, there's a form of market Leninism taking place there, but there's also a way in which the Chinese are very sophisticated at playing the Western game of capitalism.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, our idea of China is distorted by the fact that China is the great unknown, and therefore, you know, it's our enemy. China is still a communist country, which is, you know, a word that we can't pronounce. And then finally, I think it's distorted by our arrogance. We think that, you know, we're perfect, and therefore, right. You know, anybody that's different from us, you know, must be non-perfect.
I think only an Italian writer would make an observation about the Chinese interest in Berlusconi of Italy in China. What's that about?
Well, I mean, you know, what I talk about in the book is the difference between the Chinese politicians and, you know, our Western politicians. The Chinese politician actually doesn't even know how to use a soft power. General people that are selected, as I say, democratically through the party, they stay in power for 10 years and then they go away and that's it. And then a new leadership comes. Well, you know, of course, in the West, we have the politician that becomes a celebrity that is elected on the basis of his manipulation of the media. Politician that is elected because he says to people what people want to hear in that moment, and then he doesn't do anything.
Well, listen, I know that you have to leave us, you know, at 125, which is it is pretty much right now. So, you know, I just wanted to say this is a fascinating conversation. Loretta Napoleoni has written some major books published by Seven Story Press in this country, including Maonomics. She appears in my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, because she worked in finance and talks about it. One of the DVD extras in the documentary. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it yet, Loretta.
Yes, I did. It was fantastic.
It was about sex.
Yes.
I did an interview with you about, you know, sex and Wall Street. And you said,
yes.
Sex. That's all that they talk about there, sex.
Yes.
I thought that was fantastic. And I love seeing you, and I'm so happy you could come on the program. And I want everybody listening to buy this book, Maonomics, Loretta Napoleoni, Seven Story Press. A must read. And this interview, by the way, I'm going to send you the podcast once I find out how to get it to you, and you can put it on your website, this interview.
Yes.
Because I know I'm talking a lot, but we don't have a lot of time. But, you know, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Danny. It was lovely to meet you in Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
Okay.
So as we say here in New York, ciao. Okay. Bye-bye now. All right. So we're moving on here on the News Dissector radio show. Todd Gitlin is going to be up next, we hope, and to talk with us. He's a historian, professor at Columbia University, controversial in his own right, former president of the Students for Democratic Society, brilliant analyst. He had a long piece in the New York Times Sunday magazine, whatever they're calling it now, a week ago. I ran into him at Occupy Wall Street. He was right down with the people sitting there checking it all out, as some kind of intriguing observations, and he's going to join us in talking about that. And then, of course, if you want to join us, you can do so at 1-888-874-4888. That's the call-in number on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We're here every week at this time. This is a program that's sort of based on my blog, NewsDissector.com. This morning I did some live blogging about what was happening on Wall Street. Kat was phoning in reports. We, I think, did a pretty good job of offering coverage of what was happening there, and I also relied on a bunch of other sources. I've been covering this, you know, I've been interviewed by Chinese media, Russian media, Iranian media, you know, and some American media as well, as on Democracy Now! Earlier in the week, and hopefully that will continue. As on with Curtis Sliwa, conservative, you know, radio host and all-around character, this morning. I was on several times. He wanted updates on what was happening. We had kind of a feisty debate, and that's what we need to have. We need to have more discussion between people of different political views values and see where we what we have in common and what we agree on. I mean, for example, a cat is wearing an End the Fed T-shirt here. I mean, this is supposedly a right-wing libertarian cause. I think a lot of people on the left, the liberals, also think the Fed has a lot of power that's completely unchecked by our by the people. So this is an issue that resonates with people across the spectrum, and that's why Occupy Wall Street is so fascinating, because it's not following the formula. It's not top-down, you know, just well-known leaders. It's the people actually organizing all of this, and they did an amazing job this morning in holding off a threatened cleaning or clearing of the site. Obviously, that could still happen. You know, there's a lot of uncertainties here. Whenever you struggle, whenever you fight for something, you never know exactly what the outcome is going to be. But it's obvious that this movement resonates with a lot of people. A number I saw, you know, this morning and reported in my blog, which was, I think, correct, something like 868 occupations in 78 countries are going on right now. This is a worldwide movement. I'm trying to get Matt, who works behind the board here, to come down to Wall Street and check it out for himself. He might might catch the fever, but I don't know if he will or not. Gary's been there. Other people from PRN have been covering it. We went live from there last week. You should come and experience it. I think that's really the main thing. You learn by doing. You learn by participating. And that's what the people there are doing. That's why it's so exciting. I'll be back in a minute here on PRN for the second half of News Dissector Radio. Stay with me.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops,
and bank walking with AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.
Well, Todd, I wanted you to hear a little of our theme song, Plunder, which is the theme song of my film. You know, I always like to have some cool music associated with my projects, and this is a song by Polarity One, a lot of music about the economy that we've also used. Todd Gitlin is joining us. Todd is somebody I've known, I have to confess, for a long, long time, back in the Bronx, back when he was president of SDS, back even when he was leading students working for nuclear disarmament, going to the White House. He went to the Bronx High School of Science. I went up the street to DeWitt Clinton. I just learned that his father taught at DeWitt Clinton. So we have this bond, and I have a great deal of respect for his work and the questions he asked, which are not always popular questions, not always questions that resonate with a groupthink type of movement. Todd also has a book out called The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election. And we're going to get into that as well. Where are you right now, Todd? It's a little noisy.
I'm sitting in Bryant Park, having just come back on the train from Boston, where I was at a panel forum last night at Harvard with couple of hundred occupiers of Occupy Boston.
Well, how cool. So you are now the sole occupier of Bryant Park, occupying the library.
You know, there are actually a lot of people occupying Bryant Park, but I think they're otherwise occupied.
Well, what's a cool thing about the site down on Occupy Wall Street, though, is this thing called the library that they've set
yes,
up there.
I know.
And they're giving away books.
Yeah.
And yesterday, you know, trucks were pulling up from publishers, dumping, you know, all the books.
I got to tell you, I brought a box of books down yesterday morning. I know exactly what you're talking
about. And I'm sure they were gone in a flash. People can go there and actually read there, or they could get books for free. And this is important considering the fact that so many bookstores have closed. Todd, give me your sense of this. What did you tell the people at Harvard? What is your take on Occupy Wall Street? In a way, it's sort of inverting a lot of the ideas of, you know, leadership and student movement structure, top-down, blah, blah.
Well, we know that this is something astonishing, and we know that it's multi-pronged and could have a number of different futures. I mean, I think everybody has to be astonished at how much has been achieved in less than a month.
You know, it's funny because the mainstream media people say, well, what are your goals? What are your demands?
Well, look, I was on the October 5th march from the park to Foley Square, and the overwhelmingly most popular chant was, we are the 99%. Now, how much do you have to know to decode that message? I think that's extremely clear. And the second most popular chant was, banks got bailed out, we got sold out. Also, you don't need to be the proverbial rocket scientist to figure out what that is. Obviously, what this movement is about is curbing the power of plutocracy, which has been the dominant force in American life for four decades now. Now,
explain what that is, plutocracy, because not everybody...
Rule by the wealthy.
There you go. Very simple. Okay.
Yeah, very simple. So we have two parties. One of them shares ownership with the Christian right. The plutocracy is a sort of co-leader with that. And the other one is the Democratic Party, which shares ownership with a progressive side. So, but the plutocracy, in other words, owns sort of more or less one to one and a half parties. And so I think it's obvious, and for any thoughtful person, that this movement, although it's a movement, therefore it's not a president, it's not a committee, it's not it's not a bank, in fact. It doesn't have a line, but that the general thrust of it is toward reducing the power of the plutocrats. Now, how do you do that? There will be differences. There are differences, and there will be more differences, and I'm concerned about whether people who share those, who have those differences, can be respectful of others. I've been having some discussions the last couple of nights, one in New York and one in Boston, with local organizers who are actually more, what shall I say, more militant than I am in this setting and more cavalier about the political consequences. And I worry more about the consequences of various sort of follow-on actions that might follow. But in any case, I urge people, whatever their views on where to go from here, to have that discussion. And just having that discussion is a huge achievement. I don't know how, I mean, it's a staggering thing that in a month, suddenly people who never really encountered each other are, you know, arguing about whether there should be a tax on financial transactions or what kind of tax progressivity or whether there should be a revolution in the next 15 minutes. Whatever it is, that discussion, which has been so long in the deep freeze, is now out in the open. That's a huge achievement.
And I think what's fabulous about it, what's so inspiring to me, is, you know, being there and I'm in a discussion with somebody, someone else joins the discussion and they usually have something thoughtful to say, you know, and the conversation branches out in other directions, but, you know, it doesn't totally lose its focus. And there are a lot of people there from different backgrounds, different parts of the country, different parts of the world who are interacting with each other in a peaceful, nonviolent setting. And not being intimidated, you know, they don't have to have a certain line in order to speak and or to be heard.
Well, I want to underscore the magic word in what you just said, and that is nonviolent. Because as long as this movement is nonviolent, it actually can lay claim to the sympathy of, if not 99%, maybe 79%. And in the world, it probably is 99%. And think back to what seemed like a promising beginning for a movement in 1999 in Seattle. As a friend of mine who went down to the mall said the other day, all beginnings are beautiful. And the what was called then the Turtle Teamster Alliance of union people and Greens in Seattle marching to make demands on the WTA, trade demands, was actually a brilliant sort of breakthrough between the different cultures of the left, roughly speaking. But then the story became the guys in the black masks who were smashing windows. And I don't think that movement ever actually recovered its footing. So everybody should act Cooley. Which, you know, by the way, I should add that there was news today. I just saw. Now you can read. You can read Amtrak on the train. It's. I mean, you can read the wires on the train. And so I saw that there is a sit-in has taken place. I think it's in San Francisco at the headquarters of Wells Fargo Bank. And there's also an action in Brooklyn in which some people from the Occupy community went to obstruct a dispossession, an eviction hearing. Now, you know, these are nonviolent actions, and they are targeted, and their meaning is clear. And one might debate tactics. That's very different from smashing windows.
Yeah, well, you know.
And, you know, I hope people are mindful of the difference.
Well, you know, part of this whole thing is a moral footing. You know, that this movement, even though it's, quote, vague, you know, it doesn't have a muddled in the eyes of some of in the media, doesn't have a clear message, blah, 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 you know, nevertheless has a presence. And that presence is reflected in media all over the world. This thing is going global, you know, at the speed of light, you know, in many ways. There, yesterday, there was like some 700,000 people around the world who have signed a petition of support. And that seems to be growing, you know, by the minute. This week,
I just
want to say one thing about the historical moment. You know, this is the weekend of, I think, the commemoration of the Martin Luther King statue on the Mall in Washington. And there's going to be a luncheon I was invited to. I don't know if I can go, but We Marched with Martin. Andy Young is organizing, you know, in Washington to keep the King legacy alive. You know, King who said, you know, we have a right to fight for what is right. And, you know, his memory, you know, is part of a whole tradition of nonviolence, maybe, you know, in this country, which we have to respect and revere.
I agree. And I want to add one thing, which is a subject that came up a lot at this forum at Harvard. Much of this from a wonderful man named Marshall Gans, who I've known for a long time, who was once an organizer with SNCC in Mississippi and then one of the central organizers of the Farm Workers Union,
mm-hmm.
And teaches organizing, in fact, at the Kennedy School. And he is quite fierce on the subject of building something enduring. Building a movement is different from tweeting, although it can use tweeting. And it can use meetings, it can, all kinds of things it can use. But, you know, the plutocracy, the grip of corporate wealth has been growing for 40 years. You didn't get to this 1% own 40% of the wealth overnight. It's just not going to be overturned next week. And it requires endurance. And, you know, people, at the same time, they're acting sensibly in this moment ought to be thinking about what it will take to actually make this thing endure and grow. And, you know, we're all very excited, and I think properly so. But sort of now comes something harder, just as the overthrow of Mubarak actually turned out to be the easy part in Egypt. I mean, it seems inane to say it that way, but Egyptians say that now. And so that's my sort of general sermon.
Well, it's an important one, and it has within it all sorts of questions, not only about what should be done, but what I should do, what you should do, how we all can take part in this and understand this is, you know, a commitment to really a politics of change, not necessarily a politics, a party politics. I'm sure, what's your take on the Democratic Party reaction to this? Because it makes them seemingly a bit uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of voices that have not been heard from. The ones who particularly interest me in their silence are Chuck Schumer, our very own senator from New York and Wall Street, and I've yet seen a remark from him. All these people should be asked, by the way, and demanded to react. If they think the movement is too vague, what are their demands? What is their program? Why aren't they drafting a 5 or 10 point contract with America? There are 10 things you can do to reduce inequality and change the dynamic in American life. Nancy Pelosi spoke strongly the other day. I heard her on the radio. A couple of other congressmen I've heard from the Progressive Caucus, also strongly sympathetic. Obama, one blogger, I forget who it was, characterized his reaction at the press conference last week as tiptoeing. He said he understood. I guess almost everybody says they understand now. Ben Bernanke said he understood people's frustration. The one exception, interestingly enough, was the chief of staff of the White House, Bill Daley,
yeah, right.
Who was asked by somebody, is this helpful? And he said no, which is clueless and also the kind of thing you'd expect from a one percenter, which he is. Not that all one percenters are wicked, but I think you're exactly right that everybody should be thinking about where they go with this, and that Obama has a very enormous, really an enormous chance now, I think, to reclaim some of the energy that he's forfeited from what was a big part of his base. I think if he doesn't, let me put it this way, the negative is clear. If he doesn't convince the proto-activists that he is not just better than Eric Cantor or Mitt Romney, but that he is actually changing course, that he's learned that you can't play nice with John Boehner and David Koch. If he doesn't make that clear, then I think he's actually sunk in his relative standing. Even though he's belatedly decided to go progressive, I think now there are new facts, and one of the new facts is that there are a lot of people, many of whom in my conversations actually at least supported Obama and voted for him if they didn't work for him actually in 2008, including some of the most militant people I've met. But they have to be persuaded now that he's not just pulling the wool over their eyes. And, you know, deep suspicion is certainly one spirit. A lot of people in the last week, I've noticed, are talking about the danger of co-optation.
Right, I was going to bring that up.
I sort of tend to side with Peter Dreyer at Occidental College in L.A., who said something to the effect of, you know, are they co-opting us? I hope so. meaning that you want politicians to take this side, not because you plan to lapse into their arms in a swoon, but because it's a sign that they actually recognize your political power. It's a victory. Just as it was a victory to keep Bloomberg and Zuccotti proprietors from sending in the police this morning. Victories are important, and if you're talking about the long run, I think it's fine to pick up supporters as you go.
And there is a bit of a, you know, kind of a backward, you know, kind of reach into conspiracy theorizing. You know, George Soros is behind everything. I have a good friend who is one of the first people to formulate the 99% 1% effort, and he's being, you know, attacked. He's a traitor. He's selling. I mean, you've experienced this, I'm sure, yourself, Todd, of being baited by the correct liners. And who don't have a perspective about how to build a movement. They have a perspective how to try to destroy a movement.
Well, that's true, although I would actually be a bit kinder. I have a lot of respect for the people who made this happen. They took initiative. And that is not a small thing, because we've all many of us have been sitting around moaning and bitching for, you know, years now. And these people actually created new facts. I mean, that changes the world, and so I it's with utmost respect that I say now the problems are actually different. The problem is not sparking something that was overdue. The problem is harnessing that energy to make something enduring happen, and that is the collective work of all of us.
Well, I'd like to amen that. I also want to just mention, because I hope to have you on earlier, your new book, The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, that you wrote with Leo Leibovitz. Can you just give us a quick summary of your argument there?
Yeah, the both the Jews and Americans fancy that they are chosen by God, but the reason was never clear. God didn't tell Abraham what was so great about them. In fact, that's an enduring problem, a challenge. That's what his deals. And Americans also, who were founded in the fancy that we were God's new Israel, have also taken for granted a kind of entitlement. So today, in the present-day Israel, obviously is in the throes of a sense of entitlement, as are Americans. And speaking specifically about the politics of Israel, I mean, one thing we lament, we don't think, the idea of chosenness is extremely dangerous, but we don't think it can be repealed. It's too late. The whole last several millennia are built on this foundation, which is so seductive for people that it inspires emulation and resentment. Both Christianity and Islam are built in part on, you know, having been impressed by what you get out of life when you feel chosen. So, you know, the message for Israelis is, you know, for Zionists, I would say, in this argument is, okay, you want Israel to be recognized as a Jewish state? Fine. Be a Jewish state. Jewish not in the sense of text and doctrine, but in the sense of morality. You are, you know, you're not just another people. You're not going to, Israel should not be the state of the Jews as, you know, Denmark is the state of the Danes. You have obligations, and starting with ending the occupation, I think you can see where this is going. So,
well, so you're, we're against that occupation, but we're for this occupation,
yeah,
in New York, isn't it? Yeah.
And this is the moment you have to choose your occupation.
And it's exciting. And Todd, I know you have to run, so I wanted to thank you so much for being
Danny,
on with us.
Real
Todd,
pleasure.
Todd Gitlin, Columbia University professor, author, writer, activist. Todd, are you still there? I guess not.
I am.
I just wanted one last word. You know, we lost one of the activists of the 60s, who's a friend of yours and mine, Carl Oglesby. There's going to be a memorial in Boston. Can you just say a few words about Carl's contribution?
Am I still with you?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Carl was the great orator of the New Left. He was a majestic figure, unlike most of us who got in when we were young and relatively footloose. He was a married man with three kids and a job in a defense think tank and three kids. And he was a very powerful mind who thought things through freshly. He came from a background quite different from most of the New Left. He was a grandson of South Carolinian and Alabaman hill people. Is one of his grandfathers was a coal miner. His father was a rubber worker. He himself worked in the rubber plant in Akron, Ohio. He was, he didn't talk about America as an outsider. He, one of his most moving lines to me in his great speech about the war and empire in 1965, he said something to this effect. If we sound kind of harsh, he said, now this is a verbatim quote, don't blame me for that. Blame those who broke my American heart.
Go for it. Carl Oglesby, we remember you. I was there in 1965 with you, Todd. In fact, I remember seeing you there at the big march on Washington. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. And as you see, a lot is happening on this program, direct reports, analysis with great thinkers and people who really have a really thoughtful take on what's going on. That's what we're trying to do here on Progressive Radio Network, is to offer those perspectives, not to, you know, pollute the airwaves with more commercials and pollute the airwaves with more hype, but to actually get into the substance. People who, like Kat here, who's falling asleep because she's been up since early this morning, who's never been a reporter, was a great reporter this morning on what was happening, but instead of being on air, she was texting away. And you know, using the technology that we have today to make a difference. And I think that's really important. This radio station is trying to do it. Hopefully you're trying to do it as well. So there's some stuff you can do if you want to be involved in this movement. I'm going to make a couple of suggestions right now about being involved in this Occupy movement on some level that's comfortable to you, in some way that you that doesn't put you under a lot of stress, that actually integrates you into a community of people who you can learn from. And you learn by doing. You learn by participating. And I think that's the strength of it. And Occupy Wall Street is, you know, has lived to fight another day, and you can fight with them. Tomorrow there's going to be a march apparently on Times Square, which is going to be a big one. You can certainly take part in that. This is an ongoing process and an ongoing movement. If you're interested in my own work, please visit me on newsdissector.com, my daily blog. If you're interested in my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, you can go to plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. We're also having a screening next week. Do you want to tell us about it, Kat?
Yeah, sure. It's next Saturday, October 22nd, 6 p.m. at the Inn Studios, which is 54 Walker Street. It's for donation.
It's INN, International News Network. It's 54 Walker Street in Tribeca, 6 p.m. next Saturday night. Please come and see Plunder. Help me get this movie to more people, because I think it really raises the deeper questions of financial crime that's missing in our media. And it's an issue that you should know more about. I also have a book, The Crime of Our Time, which you can check out as well. I'm looking for anybody who wants to help with this radio show, help with my blog, particularly interested in people who might have some technical skills to contribute. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org.
Or if anybody wants to do a showing of the documentary also and have a discussion either at a school or library.
Yeah, so write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. We have some resources that I think will help you get a deeper take on what's going on. You can check out the podcast of this program with Todd Gitlin, with Loretta Napoleone, with Kat, with myself. It's going to be up on the PRN website, progressiveradionetwork.com, and you can check that out and share it with people. You can forward it to others and all the rest of it. I'm on Twitter at Dissector Events. I'm on Facebook, Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, the News Dissector fan page. Please join me there for more information about what I'm up to. There's a lot going on. I'm rushing off now to do a television interview. It doesn't stop, and it's fun, and it's also, you know, hopefully reaching an audience. There are people all around the world who want to know about Occupy Wall Street, and, you know, I've been blessed to be asked by a number of media outlets. Right now I'm very big in Vladivostok in Russia for some reason, you know, because Russian state television spoke with me yesterday, Russia Today, Al Jazeera. Tomorrow I'm going to have a new story about all this on Al Jazeera's website, Al Jazeera English. I just wrote it today about what happened today, so you can check it out and see my take, see if you agree with it or disagree with it. But I'm trying to help inform people about this movement. I'm trying to learn from it as well. I hope you will as well. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. We're going to go out once again with the full song by David Rovix, Occupy Wall Street. It's a really interesting, instructional piece of music, and I want you to check it out again. R-O-V-I-C-S on YouTube.
By the politicians, because this is where the power has its seat, because 99% of us are suffering at the mercy of the madmen on this street, because all of us are victims of class warfare being waged on us by the 1%, because these greedy banksters rob the country, leaving us without the means to pay the rent. Because the last time that we had a decent government was about 1932. Because we the people are supposed to run this country, but instead it's all run by and for the few. Because now we know the rich do not pay taxes, but when they need a hand, it's us who bail them out. Because we suspected we lived in a plutocracy, But suddenly too late, there is no doubt, and so we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because both my parents lost their savings, because I have never opened an account, because the interest on my credit card just doubled, and now I can't pay the minimum amount. Because these budget cuts are just immoral, with our schools as overcrowded as they are. Because there are no buses where I live, but I can't afford to drive a car. Because so many of us don't have health insurance, the rest of us have it, but it sucks. Because the rich are flying in their private jets, while the rest of us are slogging through the muck. Because capitalism isn't working, this system has just failed to produce. Because the 1% is prospering, while the rest of us just suffer their abuse. And so